Cattle, sheep, goats, buffalo, and other range animals became quite free range indeed, and turning them into food was a tricky business. In fact, most meat for human consumption was now grown in vats, but done right. Animal husbandry proved to be carbon negative too, so that didn't go away. Deacidifying the oceans? That wasn't really possible, although there were attempts to frack the new basalt on the Mid-Atlantic Rift to capture carbonates. Also, attempts to, in effect, lime the oceans. Also, to build giant electrolysis baths and new algal life communities and so on. Still, the oceans were sick, as between a third and a half of the carbon burned in the carbon-burning years had ended up in the ocean and acidified it, making it difficult for many carbon-based creatures at the bottom of the food chain. And when the ocean is sick, humanity is sick. So this was another aspect of their era, and something to keep land agriculture itself at the front of the docket, because aquaculture, which had been one-third of humanity's food, was now a very active and complicated business, not just a matter of hauling fish out of the sea. Construction? This used to release a lot of carbon, both in the creation of cement and in the operating of building machinery. Lots of explosive power needed for these jobs. And so to continue them, biofuels were important. Biofuel carbon was dragged out of the air, collected, burned back into the air, then dragged down again. It was a cycle that needed to stay neutral. Cement itself was mostly replaced by the various graphinated composites in the so-called Anderson trifecta, very elegant. Carbon was sucked out of the air and turned into graphene, which was fixed into composites by 3D printing and used in building materials, thus sequestering it and keeping it from returning to the atmosphere. So now, even building infrastructure could be carbon negative, meaning more carbon removed from the atmosphere than added, for those of you wondering. How cool was that? Maybe so cool, it would return the world to 280 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. Maybe even start a little ice age. People shivered with anticipation at the thought, especially glaciologists. But so expensive. Economists could not help but be dubious. Because prices were always right, because the market was always right. Right? So, these newfangled inventions, so highly touted by those neo-Malthusians, still worried by the discredited Club of Rome limits to growth issues, could we really afford these things? Wouldn't everything be better sorted out by the market? Could we afford to survive? Well, this wasn't really the way to frame the question, the economist said. It was more a matter of trusting that economics and the human spirit had solved all problems around the beginning of the modern era, or in the years of the neoliberal turn. Wasn't it obvious? Just come to Davos and look at their equations. It all made sense. And the laws and the guns backing adherence to those laws all agreed. So hey, just continue down the chute and trust the experts on how things work. So guess what? There was not a consensus. Are you surprised? These interesting new technologies, adding up to what could be a carbon-negative civilization, were only one aspect of a much larger debate on how civilization should cope with the crisis inherited from previous generations of expert stupidity. And the four horses were loose on the land, so this was not the sanest of world cultures ever to occupy the planet. No, not quite the sanest. Indeed, it could be argued that as the stakes got higher, people got crazier. The tyranny of sunk costs, followed by an escalation of commitment. Very common. Common enough that it was economists who had named these actions as they are names for economic behaviors. So yeah, double down and hope for the best. Or try to change course. And as both efforts tried to seize the rudder of the great ship of state, fights broke out on the quarterdeck. Oh dear, oh my. Listen on, listener, if you dare, because history is the soap opera that hurts, the kabuki with real knives.
There is a kind of verbal fugue, if writer says so, suggested David Markson. The strangest is that which, being in many particulars most like, is in some essential particular most unlike. Thoreau discovers the Uncanny Valley, 1846.
B. Stefan and Roberto. Roberto and Stefan loved it when the Great Harbor froze over. New York's schizophrenic weather only made it happen for a week or so at a time, usually. But while the ice held, they were in a different world. The previous year, in a freeze, they had tried to make an ice boat. And though it had not been a success, they had learned some things. Now they wanted to try again. Mr. Hexter asked if he could come along.
I used to do the same thing when I was a boy, out of the North Cove Yacht Harbor.
The boys looked at each other uncertainly, but Stefan said,
Sure, Mr. H. Maybe you can help us figure out how to attach the skates to the bottom.
Hexter smiled.
We used to screw them to 2x4s, as I recall, and nail those to the bottom of whatever we had. Let me see what you've got.
So they walked right down the center of 23rd, along with hundreds of other people doing the same, and then when they hit the river, they went down to the Bloomfield Aquaculture Dock, where the boys had chained their ice boat's deck to a concrete bollard, with a box of tools and materials hidden under it.
Where do you guys get all this stuff?
Hexter asked them as he pawed through it.
Some of this is pretty decent.
We scavenge, Stefan said.
Hexter nodded uncertainly. It was almost plausible, for most of it. The city was full of junk. A trip to Governor's Island or Bayonne Bay might do it. The dockmaster, Edgardo, came by and welcomed the boys, distracting Mr. Hexter from this line of inquiry. And it turned out Edgardo knew Mr. H a little. They talked over old times for a bit, and the boys were interested to learn that Mr. Hexter had once kept a rowboat at this dock. When Edgardo moved on, the old man inspected their skates.
They look serviceable.
But how do you attach them so you can steer? Stefan asked.
Only the front one has to move. That one has to have, like, a rudder.
As he pawed through their materials and tools, he said,
So how are you guys feeling about your treasure, eh? Are you okay with how it's being handled?
The boys shrugged. Roberto said,
It bugs me that it isn't being put in a museum or something. I don't think they should melt the coins down. They've got to be worth more as ancient coins, don't they?
I don't know, Mr. Hexter said. I bet you'd like one or two yourselves, eh? You could punch a hole in one and make it into a necklace.
The boys nodded thoughtfully, trying to imagine it.
That would be a block necklace for sure, Roberto said. What about you, Mr. Hexter? What do you think about it?
I'm not sure, Hexter said. I guess I think if we come out of it okay, like room and board forever and a trust fund for you guys as adults, then I'll be happy. You guys should see the world and all. Me? All I want is a new map cabinet. I mean, beyond the necessities. Got to have the necessities, that's for sure.
That's why they call them that, Stefan supposed.
While they talked this over, they worked on the ice boat. The boys had obtained an aluminum mast with a mainsail on a boom, made to be stepped into a box at the bottom of a rowboat. So they made a foot box and nailed it in place under and a bit behind the front apex of their triangular deck, and cut a hole through the deck into it. The mast would stick through this hole into the foot box. Then they nailed a frame of 2x6s to the underside of the deck. 2 ice skate blades could then be screwed into the back corners of this frame, the blades facing permanently straight ahead. The one at the front of the triangle, the bow of their boat, they screwed to a circle of plywood. Then they fit that circle inside a square frame nailed to the bottom of the deck just before the mast, under another hole in the deck that allowed a rudder post, screwed to the top of the circle of plywood, to stick up through the deck. The rudder post had a crossbar nailed to its top, and they tied lines to both ends of this crossbar, and ran these back on each side of the mast to the stern, where they tied them to cleats they screwed into the deck. Adjusting the lines would allow them to turn the front skate. With some 2x4 supports nailed in for their mast, they were good to go.
Add a brake, Mr. Hexter advised. Just a handbrake. A 2x4 on a hinge hanging off the stern. Something you can pull down onto the ice if you want to.
He pawed through their junk and held up an old brass door hinge.
Will that work? Roberto asked. Just wood on ice, I mean?
Not very well, but anything is better than nothing, at least sometimes.
They blew into their hands when they took their gloves off to work and jumped around to create some heat. The sun, hanging in an opalescent smear over Staten Island, warmed them more than seemed likely, but it was still cold.
What can we do for our next thing, Mr. Hexter? Roberto asked as they worked. We need something new, now that we've found the Hussar.
Well, there's nothing like the Hussar.
But there must be something.
Hexter nodded.
New York is infinite, he allowed. Let me think about that one. Ah, sure. Well, you know that Herman Melville lived in New York for most of his life.
Who's he?
Herman Melville, author of Moby Dick.
Okay, that sounds like an interesting book.
Both of them guffawed.
Tell us more.
Boys, he wrote the great American novel, and when it was published, it killed his career. People used it for toilet paper for a century or so, and for the rest of his life, he had to find other jobs to support his family. He kept on scribbling, and they found all kinds of masterpieces stuck in shoeboxes after he died. But for the rest of his life, he had to scrape to get by.
Like us.
That's right. He was a water rat. But he scored a job as a customs inspector, working the docks just south of here. Herman Melville, Customs Inspector. That's the title of my own lost masterpiece. But his lost masterpiece was a manuscript he called Isle of the Cross. It was about a woman who married a sailor who got her pregnant and then sailed off and married other girls in other ports. And this girl had to get by on her own after he left.
Like Melville after his readers left, Stefan observed.
Very good. That's probably right. Anyway, his publishers rejected this book outright, and it's been said Melville took it home and burned it in his fireplace.
Why would he do that?
He was mad. But maybe he didn't. That's what Russ said happened, but other people said it was there in another shoebox. And the thing is, he lived on East 26th, in a big townhouse just a block off Madison Square.
Our square?
That's right. I tell you, that little Bacino you live in has had an amazing life. It's some kind of power spot.
A manuscript isn't going to hold up underwater like gold, Roberto pointed out.
No. No, that lost novel is probably lost for good.
It's too bad.
But anything from Melville's house would be great to find. And it's like the Hussar, in that you can dig around at the bottom of the canal where his house used to be without anyone minding.
But that underwater digging turned out to be hard, Stefan pointed out. We need Idelba and Tabo.
True, but we could probably get them again, if you found the right place. And finding the old address shouldn't be hard, because we know right where it is. So, you know, if you could find anything, some wood, or something like Melville's toothbrush cup, or a Scrimshaw inkwell, or something like that.
Great idea, Roberto enthused. Stefan looked unconvinced.
We left our diving bell up in the Bronx, after it almost killed you.
We could go back and get it.
Looks like we've about finished making this ice boat, Mr. Hexter observed.
Let's give it a try, Roberto cried.
There was a gusty north wind whistling down the Hudson, not too strong, not crushingly cold. So they lifted the craft down onto the ice just offshore and got on its plywood deck, and shoved off with their shoes against the ice while pulling the sail taut. Immediately, the wind filled the sail, and Roberto wrapped the boom sheet once around a cleat they had screwed into the middle of the plywood. Stefan tugged on the two lines running up to the rudder post until the front skate pointed a little to the right, up into the wind, then wrapped those lines to their own cleats. At that point, they were on a beam reach headed west, out across the mighty Hudson, scraping and screeching along. A gust struck, and rather than tilting like a sailboat, the ice boat simply shot faster across the ice, a startling acceleration marked by louder scraping and a new hiss. Stefan and Roberto looked at each other round-eyed, and they might even have been nervous if Mr. Hexter had not been grinning a huge, gap-toothed grin, a joyful smile the likes of which they had never seen on him. Clearly he was familiar with ice boating, and loved it, so Roberto kept the sail taut, and Stefan pulled the front skate a little more to the right, pointing them up into the wind a bit more, and they clatter-swooshed across the mighty river, which from this vantage appeared like an immense ice lake, like one of the Great Lakes, maybe. Or, given the giant towers of the city and Hoboken to each side, like an ice hockey rink for Titans. They hissed along like some kind of ice hydrofoil. But the wind was cold out here, and they huddled down into their jackets and pulled their wool caps over their ears, their hands chilling despite their gloves. "Point right up into the wind!" Mr. Hexter shouted. Stefan uncleated his lines and pulled hard on the right one, which made the boat curve to the right, upriver and upwind, until the sail fluttered hard, and they scratched over the ice to a halt, with only the flapping sail moving. The wind still gusted by, throwing a mother-of-pearl sky south over them. The very hardest gust scraped the whole boat backward a foot or two at a time. "Amazing!" Roberto said. "I forgot how cold ice boating is," Mr. Hexter said, looking a little chastened. "Ours was more like a regular boat, so we had a cockpit we could get down into and get some protection. We'd always have a lot of blankets, too, and thick gloves, and hot chocolate in a thermos." Roberto, white-lipped and already shivering a little, said, "I think we could borrow some gloves and blankets. I think Edgardo has some."
"We should have thought of it before," Stefan said.
"Let's just sail back in," Mr. Hexter said. "We aren't that far out yet." To the boys, it looked like they were already almost most of the way to Jersey. But Mr. Hexter shook his head and told them to look at the size of the boats on the Hoboken docks compared to the ones back in the city. The boys still couldn't see it, but they were willing to take his word for it. Stefan pulled on his lines, twisting the front skate left to get them to turn the front back toward the city as they were being shoved backward. When they had slid until they were pointed toward Manhattan, Roberto pulled the sail taut, and the boat scraped a little sideways downwind, then began hissing and scrunching toward the city.
"Don't let the boom hit you!"
the old man cried, as with a sudden ferocious rush they accelerated. Roberto hauled with all his might on the sheet and cleated it down before he lost it, and Stefan lay down to stay under the boom, which was now angled over the right side of the boat instead of the left. Loud, clattery hiss. Tremendous acceleration. They'd never felt anything like it. Astonishing speed. Even Franklin Gar's Zoomer couldn't have beat it. Then there came a loud snap from the bow, and the deck dropped at the front. Quickly, they ground to a halt, the three of them sliding down the plywood toward the ice.
"Uncleat the sail!" Mr. Hexter said to Roberto. "Lose the sail, quick!"
When Roberto got the sheet loose from the cleat, the sail was freed to flap downwind on the boom, which swung wildly back and forth. They regained their composure, stood, and walked around on the ice. In some places it was translucent, even transparent. These patches were creepy, as below their ice the black water still clearly moved. It turned out the front skate and its circular mounting had together broken away from the square framework, now split on both sides.
"Too much stress," Hexter said, "and from a new direction."
He inspected the damage, shook his head.
"Too bad. I don't think we can fix it."
"Oh no, what are we going to do?"
"Let's walk it back in. Here. Wrap those steering lines around the very front of the bow, and lift up on the lines, and we'll walk it in on its back skates. It won't be that heavy."
They stood on the ice next to the boat, and wrapped the lines in the way he had suggested. When they were done, they could lift the bow enough to pull the boat along behind them. After a while, they stopped and unstepped the mast and laid it and the sail and boom flat on the deck. After that, tromping back toward the city felt quite satisfying.
"This is cool," Roberto said. "Usually when we mess up, we're stuck."
Mr. Hexter laughed.
"It's another reason to like ice boating. When you capsize in water, you can't just walk home like this. I think we just have to figure out a stronger frame to put the front skate in. Maybe there's an assemblage you could buy and just tack it in place. There must be ice boat makers all around this harbor by now, right?"
The boys agreed it must be so.
"But we don't have any money to pay for anything."
"Yes, you do. Give them a gold guinea, hey? See what kind of change they give you for that."
It was still cold, so they tried to hurry the old man a little, but he was slowing from time to look around. The boys tried to be indulgent, but then he stopped outright and stood looking around.
"What?" Roberto complained.
"This is the spot. This is the spot, right here."
"What spot could be out here?" Stefan wondered.
"This is where I met Herman Melville. I can tell from the way our dock lines up with the Empire State Building."
"So you knew this Melville guy?"
"No,"
Hexter laughed.
"No, I wish I had. I bet it would have been really interesting. But he was before my time."
"So how is it you met him?"
"It was his ghost. I ran into him out here and talked to him. Very weird, to be sure. An uncanny encounter. He had a great accent, a bit like a New York accent, but kind of stiff. Maybe a little Dutch in it still. It was right out here, about where we're standing. What a great coincidence! Maybe that's why the boat broke here. Or why I was thinking about him earlier. Could be he's out here still, tweaking my head."
Stefan and Roberto stared at him. He looked at them and smiled.
"Come on, we'll keep walking. You boys look cold. I'll tell you about it as we go."
"Good idea."
So as they trudged over the ice, which was mostly white in this area, and crusted with low lines of compacted snow that Hexter called sastrugi, he told them the story.
"I was out here one night in a little rubber motorboat, kind of like yours. A Zodiac, we called them then."
"We still do."
"Good to know. So I was out here..."
"Why were you out here at night?"
"Well, that's a long story. I'll tell you that another time. But basically, I was out here to receive some smuggled goods."
"Cool. What's that?"
"What's smuggled goods, or what was I receiving?"
"What's a smuggled good?" Stefan clarified, glancing at Roberto.
"Well, some things were not supposed to be brought into the country without being taxed, or not at all. So if you snuck them in, that was smuggling."
"And what were you receiving?" Roberto asked.
"Let's talk about that part later," the old man said. "For now, I want to get to the important part, which is that I'm out here in the dark, a moonless night, sea mist coming up off the water, really glad I had GPS to tell me where I was, because there would have been no way without it, because it was getting to be like a regular sea fog, what they call a pea soup fog, very thick. I did get a glimpse of the Empire State once or twice, because it was lit up then, too, but nothing else was visible. I was just out there in a white blackness, or a black whiteness. And then out of the fog, a man comes rowing. Pretty big wooden rowboat, single man in it. He had white hair cut close, and a long white beard that kind of came down in two points. Big, barrel-chested old man, and rowing pretty hard in the fog, so he almost ran me down, because of course when you're rowing you're not looking the way you're going. Although in his case, the moment I called out to him, he swung his boat around by rowing forward one way and backward the other.
He turned on a dime, and then he was rowing at me stern forward, so he could look at me. He spun around as neat as you please. That was my first impression, that he was a really good rower. As, of course, made sense. Why? Roberto, shut up! No, that's a good one. He was good because he had rowed on a whaling ship when he was young, and they had to chase whales and spear them, and then pull their dead bodies back to the big ship by rowing them. I tell you, when you have a dead whale tied to the stern of your boat, you develop very little momentum with each stroke of the oars. So he got really good at rowing. And then, after his riding career tanked, he had that job on the docks. Lot of rowing involved with that. Herman Melville, customs inspector. My favorite book about him. Although, admittedly, I wrote it. I thought you said you didn't write it.
Roberto?
In those years, he was said to be the only honest customs inspector in Manhattan, which of course had to be incredibly dangerous. How come? Think about it. With all the others on the take, he was a danger to everyone. He was bad for smugglers, and bad for the other customs inspectors. It's amazing he didn't get shot and dumped in the river. And in fact, he had all kinds of adventures in those years. The book is mostly a detective novel, I guess you'd say, or an adventure novel where it's just one damn thing after another. Him foiling plots, people trying to kill him, crazy old Confederates trying to stir up trouble. And a lot of that happened out on the river here. Sometimes he had to row out here, when ships got backed up and were anchored in the harbor waiting for a dock to open. Row all the way to Staten Island and back. He could catch smugglers by rowing them down. They'd be sailing and the wind would die a little, and he would row those criminals down. No, he was a champion oarsman.
So what happened when you met him out here? I mean, you were smuggling too, right?
That's true. Maybe that's why he showed up. But in fact, on that night, he pulled his boat right next to mine and leaned over and peered at me. He said, "Billy, is that you? Who's..."
Shut up!
I don't know. I'm wondering now if he meant Billy Budd. But when I said no, he looked really startled, kind of scared, and he said, "Malcolm? Is that my Malcolm?" And I said, "No, I'm Gordon. Gordon Hexter."
"Who's Malcolm?"
That was the name of his older son.
"So then what?" Stefan insisted.
He looked at my Zodiac and said, "What's this, a rubber boat?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Good idea." And then, "What about your oars?" I told him I had lost them overboard, and he frowned at me like he knew I was lying, because there were no oar locks on my Zodiac. And of course steamboats were already there in this time, and the Monitor and Merrimack. And he saw the motor at the back and asked me what it was, and I said it was a fishing line reel. I should have just said it was a motor, but he just looked at me and told me he would pull me into shore. And I had to say okay, as it wouldn't make sense to say no to him at that point. So he tied a line to my bow cleat and started rowing me in. So I missed my rendezvous out there. But I wasn't thinking about that then. "How do you know where you're going in this fog?" I asked him, because he was looking back at me. He smiled a little smile under his mustache. It was the only time I saw any expression on his face. "Oh, I know," he said. "I know this river by now, I can say that. Moony night, or pouring rain, or fog as thick as the thoughts in my head. I can hear where I am. I can feel the bay's bottom, feel it like my bed under me at night. This harbor is my Pacific now. I have finally fitted myself to my circumstances." Then some kind of wave hit us from behind. I felt the wave raise me, and then saw it raise him up and let him down. I looked around, and I think I said, "What was that?" And I couldn't see anything in the fog. But the water was slick under us, and more waves kept coming and lifting me up, then dropping me back. He stopped rowing, and my Zodiac bumped into the back of his rowboat, and he leaned toward me and whispered to me, "It's that which is after thee, son. I see the line around thee." So I turned to look behind again, but I didn't see anything. And then, when I turned back around to look at him, there wasn't anything there either. He wasn't there. His rowboat wasn't there. He was just gone.
"What happened to him?" Roberto asked.
"I don't know. That's why I say he must have been a ghost, because he disappeared like that. That was the first indication I had that he wasn't real. I was pretty close to West Street by then, as I found out by puttering around a little. I was pretty freaked out, I can tell you. And even more so later, when I read that a couple of boats of dead guys were found out in the river the next day, drifting around, killed by knives. I think that's what he was telling me about. That's what he rowed me away from in the fog. I was going to get killed when that deal went down, but he rowed me away."
"Yikes," Stefan said.
"But what did he mean about the line being around you?" Roberto asked.
"Ah, well..." Now Mr. Hexter stopped walking to catch his breath and answer this. He was all caught up in his tale.
"In Moby Dick, there's a chapter called The Line, maybe the greatest chapter of all. That's where Melville describes what it was like when the whalers were rowing after whales to catch them, with the harpoonist standing up in the bow, and something like a dozen or 18 guys all rowing as hard as they could, like a crew team. There was a line coiled in a big tub in the middle of the boat, with its end tied to the end of the harpoon, and when the harpoonist throws the harpoon into the whale and it sticks, the whale dives for the bottom and the line runs out of the tub really fast. But to keep it from tangling or breaking at that sudden first pull, they have a whole bunch of the line hung around the boat on poles, so that the line can be yanked out real fast with a harpoon when the whale is hit and makes its dive. So as the guys are rowing as hard as they can, and bouncing around all over the waves and all, this line is draped all over in between them, waiting to get yanked down and away by the whale. So, if you were to accidentally get an arm or your head caught in it as it ran out, bang! Over you would go and down to the bottom with the whale."
"You're kidding," Stefan said. "That's how they did it?"
"It is. But then, right when Melville finishes describing this insane setup, he says, 'But why say more?' And points out that it's no different from the situation that anyone is in at any time. The reader reading Moby Dick by his living room fire, Melville says, is in the exact same situation as those poor sailors rowing their boat after the whale. Because the line is always there."
"Kind of depressing," Roberto pointed out.
"It is."
And yet Mr. Hexter laughed. He tilted his head up and hooted, standing out there on the ice in the sun. Finally, he pulled up on the rope they were hauling their ice boat with and said,
"See, here's the line again. But on that night, Melville helped me dodge it. And I alone escaped to tell the tale."
"Today the sky is so blue, it burns," said Joe Brainerd. "I went to Coney Island with Jean Cocteau one night. It was as if we had arrived at Constantinople," marveled Cecil Beaton.
C. Mutt and Jeff. Mutt and Jeff sit with Charlotte at their railing, sipping wine from white coffee cups. "So is it weird being back in the world?" she asks. "It was weird before." They regard the nighttime, water-floored city. The antique filigree of the Brooklyn Bridge's cable work articulates the new superscrapers on Brooklyn Heights, all lit like liquor bottles. The harbor looks vast in the winter light, big plates of ice floating orangely in the black murk of twilight. Short days still. Arguably, we're saner now than we've been before, Mutt says. Jeff shakes his head. It wouldn't be saying much, but even so, it isn't true. I'm off my nut now. I want things now. You did before, Mutt protests. Charlotte says, in dreams begin responsibilities. Jeff actually smiles at this, pleasing Mutt greatly. Delmore Schwartz, Jeff says. It's actually Yeats, Charlotte explains. Schwartz was quoting Yeats. No way! It's true. I learned that the hard way. Someone said it was Yeats, and I corrected them. I told them it was Delmore Schwartz, and then they corrected me, and they turned out to be right. Ouch. That's what I said. It wasn't someone I wanted to be corrected by. Do you mean your ex, chair of the Federal Reserve? Charlotte raises her eyebrows. Bullseye. I'm surprised he knew that. I was too, but he's full of surprises. They look down at the sheet of black water, studded with dim white icebergs. Also buildings, both lit and dark. The immensity of New York Harbor at night. Awesome. Sublime. The black, starry bay. Everyone's full of surprises, Mutt says. Did you hear Amelia Black's broadcast after her polar bears got nuked? Of course, says Jeff. Everybody did, right? It's got like 100 million views now, Charlotte confirms. Everybody, like I said. There's 9 billion people on this planet, Mutt points out. So actually that's about 1 out of every 90 people, if I got my decimal point right. That's everybody, Charlotte says. Very big saturation anyway. So what did you think? Mutt inquires of her. Charlotte shrugs. She's a ditz. She can barely string 2 thoughts together. Ah, come on. Meaning I love her, obviously. Not that obvious. Well, I do. Especially after she said all those nice things about Householders Union right in the middle of saving that crashing sky village. That broadcast has gotten a lot of views, too. That was bizarre, actually, her saying that then. I do think she has a little trouble with, I don't know what, sequential thinking. Jeff says, we're all like her. Charlotte and Mutt don't get this. Jeff explains. She wants things to go right. She's mad that they're not going right. She'd like to kill the people hurting her family. How are we any different? We have a plan, Charlotte suggests. But do we? You've got this building and the intertidal community, the Lamas and all the other co-ops, but now that things are going well, it'll all get bought up again. Wherever there's a commons, there's enclosure, and enclosure always wins. So of course she wants to kill. I'm totally with her. Put 'em against a wall. Fucking liquidation of the rentier. Euthanasia of the rentier, Charlotte corrects. Keynes. Okay, whatever. You are sounding pretty mad. But you should have seen him before, Mutt insists. I'm telling you, he's a lot calmer now. No, I'm not. Maybe a little vengeful, Charlotte says. Jeff throws his hands in the air like, what? I want justice. It sounds like you want revenge. Jeff's laugh is more like, arg. He is seizing his hair with both hands. At this point, justice and revenge are the same thing. Justice for people would be revenge on the oligarchs. So yeah, I want both. Justice is the feather in the arrow. Revenge is the tip of the arrowhead. The rentier class is not going to go down easily, says Charlotte. Of course not. But look, once you're cutting them apart, you tell them that they each get to keep 5 million. Not more, but not less. Most of them will do a cost-benefit analysis and realize that dying for a bigger number is not worth it. They'll take their 5 million and slink away. Charlotte considers this. The golden parachuting of the rentier. Sure, why not? Although I prefer to call it fiscal decapitation. It's pretty mellow as far as revenge goes. Velvet glove. Minimize the trauma drama. I always like that, she sips her wine. It would be interesting to hear what Franklin might say about that, about how we could finance it. Why him? Jeff asks. Because I like him. A very nice young man. J. Jeff shakes his head at her like he's regarding a true miracle of stupidity. Mutt, thinking to divert Jeff's no doubt withering critique of their young financier, says, "Have you ever noticed that our building is a kind of actor network that can do things? We got the cloud star, the lawyer, the building expert, the building itself, the police detective, the money man. Add the getaway driver and it's a fucking heist movie." "So who are we?" Jeff says. "We are the wise old geezers, Jeffrey." "But that's Gordon Hexter," Jeff points out. "No, we're the two old Muppets on the balcony cracking lame jokes." "Lame-ass jokes," says Mutt. "I like that."
"Me too.
But isn't it a little weird that we have all the right players here to change the world?" Charlotte shakes her head. "Confirmation bias. That or else representation error. I'm forgetting the name, shit. It's the one where you think what you see is all of what's going on. A very elementary cognitive error." "Ease of representation," Jeff says. "It's an availability heuristic. You think what you see is the totality." "That's right, that's the one." Mutt acknowledges this, but says, "On the other hand, we do have quite a crew here." Charlotte says,
"Everybody does. There are 2,000 people living in this building, and you only know 20 of them, and I only know a couple hundred, and so we think they're the important ones. But how likely is that?"
"It's just ease of representation, and every building in Lower Manhattan is the same, and they're part of the Mutual Aid Society, and those are everywhere now, all over the drowned world. Probably every intertidal building in the world is just like us. For sure everyone I meet in my job is." "So it's mistaking the particular for the general?" Mutt says.
"Something like that. And there's something like 200 major coastal cities, all just as drowned as New York. Like a billion people. And we're all wet, we're all in the precariat, we're all pissed off at Denver and the rich assholes still parading around. We all want justice and revenge."
"Which is one thing," Jeff reminds her.
"Okay, whatever. We want justice revenge."
"Just venge," Mutt tries. "Rejustinge."
It doesn't seem to combine.
"Let's leave it at justice," Charlotte suggests. "We all want justice. We demand justice," Jeff says. "We don't have it. The world is a mess because of assholes who think they can steal everything and get away with it. So we have to overwhelm them and get back to justice."
"And conditions are ripe, is that what you're saying?"
"Very ripe. People are pissed off. They're scared for their kids. That's the moment things can tip. If it works like Chenoweth's law says it does, then you only need about 15% of a population to engage in civil disobedience, and the rest see it and support it, and the oligarchy falls. You get a new legal regime. It doesn't have to get all bloody and lead to a thugocracy of violent revolutionaries. It can work, and conditions are ripe."
"So how does a thing like that start?" Charlotte wonders.
"Any kind of thing, some kind of disaster, big or small."
"Okay, good. I always like rooting for a disaster to strike."
"Everybody does."
Jeff cackles along with Charlotte. She refills their cups. Mutt feels a smile stretching his face in an almost forgotten way. He clicks ceramic cups with Jeff.
"It's good to see you happy again, my friend."
"I'm not happy. I'm furious. I'm fucking furious."
"Exactly."
In a storm, the Flatiron appeared to be moving toward me, like the bow of a monster ocean steamer. A picture of New America, still in the making, said Alfred Stieglitz.
D. Vlade. Vlade's wrist pad beeped and said, "So how's it going with our gold?"
"Hi, Idelba. Well, they're figuring it out."
"What do you mean?"
"We talked to Charlotte about it, and she convinced us to ask Inspector Jen what we should do."
"You asked a policeman?"
"A policewoman, yes."
Long pause over the radio phone. Vlade waited her out. That always worked with Idelba. He had about 50 times more patience than she did.
"And what did she say?"
She said melt it down and sell the gold and put it in the bank and don't tell anyone where we got it.
Well, good for her. I was worried you would turn it over. I've dealt with salvage before and it never goes well. So how long is that going to take? When do Thabo and I get our cut?
I'm not sure. Vlade took a deep breath, then gave it a try. Why don't you come on over and we'll talk about it with the gang here?
Like when?
Let me check on that. And listen, when you come, can you bring that vacuum you drug up the gold with? I want it to see if I can apply it to a problem I'm having with the building here.
He explained his plan. I guess so, she said.
Thanks, Idelba. I'll get back to you on when the group can meet.
Gathering the treasure consortium was hard, mainly because Charlotte was part of it now, in an advisory role, and she was mostly away, and busy even when she was home. But she carved out an hour at the end of one of her long days, and Idelba agreed to come in her tug and anchor between the tower and the north building. Vlade was still finding leaks appearing below the low tide mark on the building, small but worrisome. Actually, infuriating. Of course, one could play drone versus drone, and he did that, but it wasn't working. It seemed possible that going old school with Idelba might accomplish what he wanted, and it gave him an excuse to see her again. So Idelba showed up in her tug, which was of a size that allowed it to just fit through most of the canals of Lower Manhattan. Nervously, Vlade welcomed her to the Met and showed her around. It was the first time she had visited, so he gave her the grand tour, starting below the waterline, including the rooms that had been broached. Boathouse, dining hall, and commons, some representative apartments occupied by people he knew well, everything from the solo closets to the big group places, occupying half a floor and accommodating 100 people dorm-style, then up to the farm, then above that to the cupola and the blimp mast, then back down to the animal floor, pigs, chickens, goats, very smelly, and right under that the farm again, to get the views of the city through the loggia's open arches. Idelba seemed impressed, which pleased Vlade. Their history stood between them like a third person, but he still had his feelings. That would never change. What it was like for her, he had no idea. There was so much they had never talked about. Just the thought of trying to scared him.
It's a beauty, she said. I always like seeing it from the rivers. It stands out quite a bit, considering there are so many taller buildings.
It's true. It's in a bit of a gap, and the gold top marks it.
So what's with these leaks you're finding?
I think someone's trying to scare us. That's why I'm hoping to suck up some evidence.
Worth a try?
Thanks for helping.
Just another service from your new partner.
What do you mean? Vlade was startled by this word.
I mean, let's go talk to your chairperson.
Vlade gave Charlotte a call, and as it turned out, she was still in the building. After a while, she joined them.
This is Idelba, Vlade said to Charlotte. She and her crew helped us recover that gold from the Hussar.
We were married, too, Idelba said, not knowing that Vlade had told Charlotte about it. Just to help you understand why I would help such a creature as Vlade.
Funny, Charlotte said. I was just talking to my ex the other day.
The city is like that.
Charlotte nodded.
So, what's up? I want to know what's happening with the gold, when I'll get my share.
Charlotte said,
We're still trying to figure out how best to maximize its value. That isn't real obvious.
I can imagine, but I want in on that too. Without me and Thabo, no gold for you, and we were promised 15% of the take, and it's been 2 months. And in the winter, we can't work as much, so we're not getting paid as much. Times are tight.
I thought you were on a city contract.
No, it's just the association over there.
We get paid or given goods by people there, but sometimes we're just taking lemmas or IOUs. I understand. It's like that here, too. I just thought it was a city project. A city project in the wet zone? True. Anyway, we're talking to people to figure out what to do about the gold. Idelba wasn't happy at this. Maybe you could start payments on what you owe me. We don't have that kind of money available. What about some kind of goods exchange? Goods or services? Like how I'm helping Vlade work on your place's security?
Charlotte frowned.
Yeah, only flip it.
Idelba shrugged.
I don't know if you have anything I need. Possibly we could put you up here over the winter. You see those hotelos across the farm? We could put up a couple more, right, Vlade?
Vlade tried to imagine what it would be like living near Idelba again. Failed, but managed to say, sure, without much delay. Just enough for Idelba to give him the stink eye.
I don't think so, she said darkly.
I don't know if I want to use up any of our compensation that way. A room is a room, and we have space heaters and blankets out there.
Charlotte shrugged, imitating Idelba, Vlade saw. You can let us know.
Meanwhile, you'll work on turning that stuff, or give us some to turn?
Yes, of course. We'll have something figured out within a week.
Vlade escorted Idelba back down to the boathouse.
You should join us while it's winter, he ventured. It's nice.
I'll think about it.
Back in his boathouse office, he offered her a shot of vodka, and she sat down and sipped it. She had never been a big drinker. They sat drinking by the light of the various screens and instruments, and the boathouse's few nightlights, sharing the dimness and quiet. No huge need to keep a conversation going. They had already not said all the things they weren't going to say. It was painful to Vlade.
Here, he said. I'll show you what I'm doing with the gold.
Have you shown the boys?
Sure, but that's a good idea. It doesn't get old.
He wristed the boys as he got out the equipment from boxes under his work table, and in a few minutes they ran in, gold bug madness lighting them like gas lantern mantles.
This is so cool, Stefan promised Idelba.
Even though we shouldn't be doing it, Roberto added.
Vlade had had to look it up, but it turned out to be fairly simple. The melting point of gold was just under 2,000 degrees. He had borrowed a graphite crucible and an ingot mold, both standard salvager's equipment, from Rosario, and he already had an oxyacetylene torch in his shop. After that, it was just a matter of sprinkling some baking soda over 10 of the darkened coins when they were stacked in the crucible, putting on a welder's mask and heavy gloves, firing up the torch, and slowly cooking the gold under direct heat, until the coins turned red and slumped into a single, bumpy red mass, sizzling or bubbling very slightly at the edges. Then the mass melted further and became a fiery red puddle in the crucible. Always interesting to do and to see. Then, while it was liquid, he seized the crucible in tongs and poured the gold redly out into the ingot mold. Idelba and the boys watched with keen interest. Idelba even said, "Aha," when the coins turned red. When they deformed and melted together, leaving a scum of the sodium carbonate and dirt on the top, the boys squealed, "I'm melting," which Charlotte had taught them was appropriate. Vlade turned off the torch and flipped up the mask.
Pretty neat.
Did you let the boys here do it? Idelba asked.
Oh, yeah. It was fantastic. You see how hot it is. You feel it.
Then Idelba got pinged, and she looked at her wrist.
Are your systems showing anything outside?
He glanced at his screens, shook his head.
Yours are?
Yep. I think your radar must be baffled on this shit.
I was wondering about that.
Let's see if we can suck something up for you.
She spoke to Tabo, who was still out on the tug. Vlade went out and untied the building's runabout from the boathouse dock, and they got in and hummed out the door into the Bacino. Idelba indicated the north side, between the Met and north, under her tug. When they came around from the Bacino into the 24th Canal, Vlade saw that the tug was about half as wide as the canal. Tabo and a couple other men were standing in the bow, wrangling one of their dredging hoses, and suddenly the big vacuum pump motor revved up to its highest, banshee scream. With the pale slabs of the buildings walling them in, it was very loud. All of a sudden, the vacuum was shut off and things went quiet again. Vlade pulled up to the tug, and Tabo caught the rope Idelba threw up to him and tied them off.
"What you got?" Idelba called.
"Drone." "Oh my," Vlade said. "Hey, have you got the strong box on board there?"
"You think it might explode?"
"I don't want it to with your guys exposed to it, right?"
Idelba called sharply to Tabo and the other man in Berber, and Vlade glimpsed the whites of their eyes before they scrambled below decks on the tug. A tense minute later, they returned with a box, and one held it while the other tossed an object from the screen end of the vacuum tube into it. They worked fast.
"Okay, locked up," they called down. "Strong one?" Vlade inquired hopefully.
"That's why they call them strong boxes," Idelba said.
"I know, but you know?"
"I don't know. Who do you think you're dealing with here, the military?"
"Or someone with military stuff?"
"Shit."
Even in the dark, Idelba could do a very good slow burn, whites of her eyes.
"Well, our strong box is military too, so quit paranoiding and tell me what to do with it."
"Let's put your strong box in a bigger strong box," Vlade suggested. "I've got one in the office."
"What will you do with it then?"
"Give it to the police. We got a police inspector lives here. She'll be interested, I think. We can do that tomorrow."
"Doubt you'll get much from the drone."
"You never know. At least I can prove we're being attacked."
"Sort of. Any idea who's doing it?"
"No. But there's been an offer on the building, so it could be them. And even if we can't prove it, the fact we're getting attacked might make some residents mad and convince them to vote against the offer. There was a vote that went against it, but it was close, and the offer might get upped."
"I guess I better figure out whether I want to winter here while you still own the place."
Vlade tried to think of a snappy reply, but failed. He sighed, and Idelba heard it and quit her needling, which surprised him. Truce in the Vlade-Idelba Cold War? He would find out later. Right now, he was just happy to have her around giving him shit. Mostly happy. Well, happy wasn't the right word for it. He wanted her around in a tense, apprehensive, unhappy, even miserable way. But he wanted it.
The largest apartment of which we found record was sold to John Markell, 41 rooms and 17 baths, at 1060 Fifth Avenue, for $375,000. The story goes that shortly after Mr. Markell moved in, a servant unlocked a door that nobody had noticed, and discovered 10 rooms they didn't know they had. Helen Josephie and Mary Margaret McBride. New York is everybody's town. Labor, noun. One of the processes by which A acquires property for B. Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary.
E. Inspector Jen. After a sudden February thaw, Inspector Jen had to take the sky bridges again, having been enjoying her walks on the frozen canals, and she was headed for the one that ran over to 1 Madison, intending to proceed east from there to the station, when Vlade stopped her at the doors to the skyway.
"Hey there, Jen. I got something I want to give you."
He explained that he and his friend Idelba had sucked a submarine drone out of the canal next to the Met, and that they had put it in a strong box in case it exploded, because he suspected it was there to drill a hole in the building. "I know you can't carry it to the station, but can you send some of your people over to pick it up? I've got it in my safe in the office.